Welcome to the European CME Forum podcast. European CME Forum is a not-for-profit organization that promotes multi-channel discussion on matters relating to European and global CME CPD. My name is Eugene Pozniak. I'm the program director of CME Forum. The 16th annual European CME Forum took place from 8th to the 10th of November 2023 in The Hague, the Netherlands. The theme of this year's meeting was Voices in CME CPD, which we address from three angles, to include external voices in CME CPD, our own internal voices, and listening to each other's voices. To round off what has been an eventful year in CME CPD, we've put together two podcast episodes with some of our highlights from 16 ECF. In this first episode, we will showcase insights on educational outcomes, formats, and tools that were shared by our European and global education experts. One of the key themes of this year's meeting was measuring outcomes and impact in CME CPD. In our first clip, Celeste Kalanko outlines why this should be measured.
Obviously, we put education together. We do all this planning. We do needs assessments and come up with, you know, tactics and design and all of these different types of items. But at the end of the day, how do we know if they're really effective, if they've made an impact? By the way, I love that terminology, and I think we're going to start adopting that as much, if not more, of the outcomes, but impact. If they've made an impact, first of all, on whoever our target audience is, but ultimately, ideally, has this made any type of impact on the patient or community health in any way, shape, or form?
Next, Kate Regnier of the ACCME describes the levels of change that are typically measured by providers.
The change in learners that we want you to measure for is at the lowest level, competence, and then performance, and then patient outcomes. And it really depends on what you've designed the activity to measure, or designed to change, will help drive what you measure. So from an accreditor standpoint, though, you know, that's part of our framework. When we were preparing for this, I looked at some data that we have. We publish data every year about all of the education that our providers offer. For example, last year there was about 230,000 activities offered in our system. We accredit about 1,600 organizations. And we ask for every activity, what was measured? What was the change that the providers were looking for? 95% of the activities were focused on learner competence. Not surprising, because that's the lowest level that's required. And many of these things are additive, so you may have measured for competence right during the activity or right following the activity, and then chosen to measure for performance later. 40% of the activities are measuring learner performance, 16% are measuring for patient health, and 8% for community or population health. As you can imagine, as you go up Moore's levels, it gets harder and harder depending on how much access to the data you have. So that's the structure, the state of where we are in our system. We believe we have a responsibility as an accrediting body to both push and pull the educators and provide incentives for going above and beyond, mm-hmm. going higher in the levels. And so I mentioned the commendation criteria. We have a category of called accreditation with commendation that gets organizations 2 extra years. And in order to apply for that, you have to actually demonstrate that you are achieving outcomes. So you didn't just measure for it, you are actually able to demonstrate that you achieved outcomes in terms of performance, patient outcomes, or community population health. That one of those three is required. So we've chosen to use our accreditation, the core criteria as the expectation, and then the commendation criteria as the incentive to try to push towards the higher levels.
We also heard perspectives on evaluating impact in education from Stephen Kufchuk, Dean Beals, and Kate Regnier.
Evaluating impact is a process. It's not one and done. A lot of times it's going to be embedded to other things that are complementing education. So even if we did a really sophisticated, multimodal performance improvement, quality improvement initiative paired to this, you know, there's confounders. There's things that are outside this that are going to drive change in organizations. So it takes a lot to study these. And I think as educators, the challenge is here is, well, are we doing our part in designing a plan to get data and at least learn, are we moving the needle in some direction? Are we learning from the learners? And will that help us for the future planning?
But I think, you know, what we recognize is that in the United States, we are fortunate that we have access to electronic health records, to claims data, even though not a lot of people are still using them. Mm-hmm. But we're fortunate that we have access to that. And from my perspective, I think that's where our industry is heading, because it is getting harder and harder to get results from learners, particularly post-activity. And at the end of the day, we also, you know, are asking learners, did you make practice change? And anybody that spends an hour sitting listening to something is probably going to tell you they did. So how do we really demonstrate that? And that's what these higher level outcomes can hopefully do.
So. And in terms of access to that data, so we heard it's coming to Europe. Does that need a new muscle in your, you know, in your skills of interpreting that data and so on? Is that something that's aggregated?
It does require. It is different. It is a different way of looking at, rather than pre, post, and 30 day or whatever data. It requires either you learning new skills or hiring people, which is what we do in some cases, who have expertise in being able to analyze data from electronic health records, because it really is a different way of looking at some of that data. But it's important, and I think it's going to be a skill set that all of us are going to need moving forward.
Two thoughts. One, stop worrying about knowledge transfer. Like, don't teach about knowledge transfer things that they can look up on their phones. Focus the education on skills, strategy, judgment, teamwork, communications, leadership, adaptive learning, things like that, right? So take the education up away from knowledge necessarily. The second is something that we've talked about for a couple days now, and that is embed your evaluation or assessment into the education itself. It will make it more impactful unless it is really true performance improvement or quality improvement, in which case you're measuring, you're using data that's measuring those things. You don't have to ask the learners for surveys because you're going to measure their actual performance or quality improvement. But if you're not doing performance improvement or quality improvement, you're doing other types of education, put the evaluation into the education itself. Ask reflective statements at the conclusion of the activity about what they might change as a result, what they will do differently, what they will stop doing as a result of engaging in the education. It will be more impactful.
This was followed by some final words from Lawrence Sherman, who spoke about the need to be realistic about our expectations for outcomes and impact in education.
Learners will not all change because we gave them and they participated in an educational activity. So we have to be realistic when we're looking at the impact and outcomes. Y'all know the Prochaska trans-theoretical model? Readiness to change. It's like the diffusion of innovation theory in education. It takes people different amounts of time to learn or to make a change or to believe that something needs to be done. And so we have to be realistic when we set expectations with grantors, with learners, with bosses, and with ourselves, that not everything will happen the way we think it's going to happen. Right? In this room, not every piece of content was relevant to every one of us 100% of the time. So sometimes we were looking down at our phones, sometimes we were looking but not listening, right? Same with our learners. We can't assume that 100% of an activity is relevant to 100% of the learners 100% of the time. Now, maybe it is, maybe it's not. If it's curricular, maybe it is. But we have to be realistic with it, and we have to set the expectations. That's why it's okay if somebody starts a 15-minute CME activity and stops at 7 minutes. Why? Because they got to the thing that they were looking for, they learned it, and they're done. And we have to help to advocate for that.
Another key topic at the meeting was micro-learning. In this next clip, education provider Megan Coulihan shares a definition of micro-learning.
So let's talk about how we define micro-learning. So first of all, before I'm going to tell you what it is, let's talk about what it isn't. So it's not a new concept. It's been around for a while. It is not necessarily confined to just a few minutes, although it could be. As I said, the most widely accepted, I believe, is 3 to 5 minute range. Microburst is not limited to video format. You can do it in live, and we do it all the time. And it's not just, perhaps most importantly, taking one really long thing and splitting it into chapters. That doesn't count. So what is it? So it is delivering content in small, bite-sized segments, highly focused content. And that might be the most important thing that I say today regarding content is you've got to be really narrow and focused in order to be effective in microburst learning. It's able to adapt to learner pace and speed of learning. And truthfully, it's how we consume most content in 2023. If you think about the way you watch things, read things, engage in social media or otherwise, there's a lot of microbursts going on out there. It sort of happened, I think, inadvertently and accidentally, but this is the way most of us learn now.
We next hear the perspective of Mindert Sossef, a consultant surgeon and educationalist who joined us for our Getting to Know Our Audience session.
Again, in our daily practice, we're moving to shorter formats. We came from a whole day of training, and it's quite an impact. So if you squeeze it in, let's say 3 or 4 hours, the end of the day, it works better. So there is this trend to smaller training sessions.
And in terms of sort of more digital education, like webinars, podcasts, would you prefer them to be shorter, 10, 15 minutes, or do you think there's place for, you know, 60-minute, 90-minute webinars?
The popular webinars and e-learnings are short.
Reinhard Griebenau then went on to describe the impact of micro-learning in CME CPD.
We are definitely not living in a culture of learning regarding what the individual physician can invest into CME and CPD. So the question is how to serve the profession indeed with the best education, and this will still be an array of different CME modalities. This is not to scare you or to bring down your motivation to plan good education and have a good design or so. But you need to be aware that there are two realities. Those coming to attend your one day online or in person meeting, having the opportunity to do that, traveling with you the journey you have designed. And the others who need information now, who have not the time to invest into such an activity, may nevertheless use what you are offering more or less selectively. And this brings me to a different type of education and information. And that's that one of the early questions has been, you have heard from Alison, what should the participant be able to do? What will the participant be able to do? And that's how does the educational offer align with the time frame the participant can afford now? And this brings us to a completely different type of education, means that you have to solve a patient problem now. And now we are in the discussion, is it education or is it information? I think it's always education as long as it serves to treat your patients appropriately or better than before. And if you have the opportunity to solve a patient-related problem now, this is translated to Moore's pyramid, directly related to level 5 and 6. Yeah, so we are not starting from the scratch. We are talking about experts who have all the puzzle pieces available, and maybe 1, 2, 3 are missing, which need to be filled now. And that's about impact of education. Yeah, it has a direct impact on patient treatment.
We conclude this topic with a roundup of perspectives from the accreditors, represented by Natalie Paulus from IACME, Kate Regnier from ACCME, and Reinhard Griebenow of EBAC, with a final comment from Lawrence Sherman.
Yes, so we are, I would say, a very traditional organization. So doctors feel that in 15 minutes you may not learn as much as taking, for example, an e-learning activity of 1 hour. But minds are changing and attitudes are changing, and mainly also due to COVID and to providers asking us for accreditation of microlearning. So the first step was to reduce it from 1 hour to 30 minutes. Perhaps at the next conference we'll manage to reduce it from 30 minutes to 15 minutes, but that's, I'm counting on you to address this issue with the UMS decision makers, and I think that eventually you'll manage to have it.
I want to just clarify one thing about the 15 minute. So in our system, the requirement is that credit is earned in 15 minute or increments, but we know many organizations that actually do even smaller bits of learning, true micro learning. Maybe it's 2 minutes, maybe it's 3 minutes, and they just accumulate that learning in their system until at least 15 minutes is earned or quarter of a credit is earned, and then it can be awarded. So it's really important for us as accreditors and you as providers to understand all the different flexible ways that you could deliver education and just, like I said, deliver the credit in certain increments.
I think, if I might comment, just one sentence, micro-learning describes a certain type of behavior of the learner. It's not how long the unit is. And you may discuss what's a reasonable minimum duration, and that may be 15 minutes or 10 minutes or so. We yesterday had a nice example where you can have in a 10 minutes video so much information which you cannot work on in 10 minutes. Yeah, but micro learning is a certain behavior, and the question is, does the accrediting body allow this behavior?
Exactly.
And this has technical implications on the side of a provider, means tracking.
And someday we may even move away from time as the unit of measurement.
Sure. For sure.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Our final topic in today's episode focuses on the use of AI in CME CPD. The next clip features some thoughts on incorporating AI in education from Kate Regnier, Monica Ghidinelli, and David Voduszek.
I think we're at an interesting phase of the intersection of technology and different generations to be able to figure out, is it going to have a good impact, a bad impact, or is there a balance in that? I think one of the things that we've heard from our accredited providers is COVID caused all the education to go virtual, and a significant amount of it to be recorded or enduring. Some of it was live, but a lot of it recorded. And I think that we heard that clinicians missed being together because they want to be able to interact and learn from each other. And it's a shared experience of developing expertise. That's why for example, case conferences are so popular because they're really working together to solve problems. And so I think AI is going to be something that is going to be a tool and going to be used to explore and expand the information inflow, but still judgment and critical skills and differences amongst patients and social determinants of health and things like that are going to be part of the equation.
So for new formats, or what is the direction? I mean, I think that I want to make a comment regarding, so now we have a lot of new technology, we have a lot of simulation, we have virtual reality, we have augmented reality. But the thing is, the cost of these new technologies are very high. And again, there is always a budget cut for education. So there is a tendency to have more technology that is costing more, but the money put into education is reduced. So there is a little bit of an imbalance. So I would say that the future is to find the less expensive and most effective way to deliver education, mm-hmm. and not going to the most fancy one. And this is always something that we have to consider. What is the basic way in which you can have and you can fill this educational gap? And this is what we should look at, and not having these new formats and looking really what are the gaps that we have to fill and find the right solution, mm-hmm. for that.
And certainly AI in the use will induce further changes.
Correct.
And induce perhaps some people not only to rely too heavily on that, but even to become addicted in
for
a way.
Sure.
You know, like. So, I mean, but everything that's introduced in human civilization
changes.
First changes, but has positive and negative.
For sure.
Effects. So I think we cannot say, oh, we don't like AI, so it won't go away. We have to adapt, we have to be careful, we have to warn, seeing best side effects, but that's as far as we can go.
I mean, Susan, this is a very difficult question, but I think that we have really to educate surgeons. I talk about surgeons because, of course, the one that I interact most with, healthcare professionals, in interpreting and being able to use that is like an analogy with the cars, the one that are auto-guided. Who is responsible if you have a car accident? Is the company that built the car, or is the driver? So with AI and this technology will be the same, the doctors and the whoever needs still to be able to use it and interpret the data. And if it's giving you the wrong answer, you should be able to understand how to deal with certain type of and with decisions. Maybe so you need still to have all this into place. Otherwise, it will not work.
Another aspect covered by Kurt Snyder and Stephen Kufchuk was how CME CPD providers will need to adapt with the new technology.
I'm not sure if this is positive or not, but I think the business of CME is going to change a lot in the next 10 years. You know, the pandemic helped us all get a little bit more online, but I think the reality is the people in this room are small players in the technology world. Entities like Google, Coursera, edX, they're coming, and they're going to come with massive numbers and the ability to target your learners in a way that it's really going to be hard for us to compete with. And so I'm predicting that there's going to be a lot of consolidation. And Kate mentioned this notion of don't even worry about knowledge transfer. The amount of information that will be available online will be so ubiquitous that it'll be hard for us to compete in that space. By the way, another negative to that, there'll be a lot of misinformation out there as well.
Correct.
So that will be a challenge that we will all have to deal with. But my thing, and this isn't really meant to be a concern, I think it's also we have to think about how we can adapt our local meetings to leverage all that knowledge that will be available out there. But I don't think historically we have thought of these major companies as competitors. But I think in the future, in the near future, there will be competitors out there that are very, very big and are providing information. There's lots of positives to that too, by the way. A lot of information is based in countries like Europe and US are hard to get to in places around the world. And so there will be a little bit of democratization of this education. So again, there's lots of positives to this. There's also lots of, we talk about assessments. I think that the slickness of these tools will allow to pinpoint learners what they need at the time, up to date here, and they've almost had a monopoly at the point of care. I think more and more there'll be competition in that area. And so the amount of information coming is going to be amazing, and how we're going to have to adapt to figure out where we fit in into that. So that's it's going to be amazing next 10 years.
So from my point of view, it's a long-standing idea, but I think a bigger priority than ever for providers to aim higher. There's so many efforts underway to improve care goals at the clinic care or hospital care levels or community health levels, and all of those are happening without CME at the table. So whatever we can do to get at the table to drive that, because we have a lot of value add. We're not going to be the leaders of it, but we're going to amplify that. We're going to make those things more effective. So whatever you can do to marry yourselves up to those units and stay at the table is really critical for our relevance in the future. And then from a technology standpoint, so think globalization. So I really don't think the issue in healthcare is expertise. I think knowledge is pretty much known consistently globally. It is really a care delivery issue at its core. And so I'm lucky to work for an integrative global healthcare system that's really working hard to make care consistent, whether you're in Cleveland, Ohio, or in Abu Dhabi, or in London, et cetera. And so we're tinkering with VR to where we're having teams practice all sorts of scenarios that's not geographically bound. So these people are never going to be caring for the same patient together, but they're going to work as if they're the same team caring for patients consistently. And so I'm, and this is new, we're tinkering with it. I don't know how that's going to work, but I think technology can be harnessed to make care more consistent.
We also heard an accreditor perspective on the use of AI from Kate Regnier.
So from an accrediting body perspective, there's a couple of different things going on. First of all, and many of you probably are doing the same, we're trying to look at what policies to set for our own staff on the use of AI. You realize if you put questions or queries or information in to the large language models, it becomes public. And so you've got to be really careful about confidential information. So that's internal. External, we're looking at what use AI could have in actual accreditation and or disclosure by the providers if they've used AI, for example, to write their self-study report. I was at a meeting just 2 weeks ago, and one of the academic medical centers in the US put in a bunch of statements about the value of accreditation with commendation from the ACCME, and it spit out this wonderful, amazing paragraph that I think we should use more. So it's kind of interesting to think about full disclosure in actual accreditation. And then probably most importantly, what policies you might have for your faculty about the use of AI in developing content. And the fact that even if AI is used, you have to assure the content is valid. There's still significant flaws in the system about whether things are accurate, reliable, valid. So the faculty use and then disclosure to the learners. Several of the large journals, at least in the US, I'm sure here, are starting to require the disclosure of AI as a journal author, if it has been used in the creation of an article. So those are the sort of regulatory things we're looking at.
We conclude this segment with some final thoughts from Lawrence Sherman on looking ahead to a new generation of learners.
So I think it's interesting, but I don't think it's just us that has to think about this. Mm-hmm. I was recently at a conference, and it was primarily undergraduate mm-hmm. health professions educators. And they're looking at how they have to change the curriculum mm-hmm. and the way they're teaching the students. Because before, we taught students to have all the answers and then update them regularly. Now they have to teach them to be master adaptive learners, to know where to go, to know how to use new technology, how to put it into place, how to test if it's working, and how to then make the change in practice. So we're going to inherit a different generation of learners right. very soon. Right. So we need to have the conversations with those folks so we know how the learners are being prepared to be lifelong learners, which is different from the way some of us were prepared in the last century.
We hope you enjoyed these select highlights on educational design and outcomes from 16ECF. If you attended the meeting, please complete the brief post-meeting survey and let us know your thoughts. There's a link in the show notes. As you will have seen during the meeting, your feedback is really important in our future planning. Registered participants will also have exclusive access to recordings from the meeting sessions, which will be made live in the new year. Thank you for listening, and tune in next time for part two, our final episode of the year, where we will share further highlights from 16ECF about the rules and regulations around CME-CPD, accreditation, compliance, the grant proposal process, as well as providing some additional background to EACME 3.0, the exclusion of UK learners from industry-funded international accredited CME, and other things relating to European and global CME-CPD.